You are listening to The Christian Commute, a commute-length podcast about Christian apologetics, theology, and other matters of Christian interest. Here is your host, Seth Dunn.
It is Tuesday, August 3rd. You are listening to The Christian Commute, and you're riding home with me, your host, Seth Dunn, on what can be properly termed as a Franken show. Why is it a Franken show? Because it's going to be one show made of disparate parts. It has been, over a week since I released a new show. I just happened to have come to work today, but I may not come to work for the rest of the week. So since I drove to work today, I'm doing a show, but here's how I'm doing it since I'm behind. On the way here, I recorded a show topic, which I am going to put on the back of this Bible chapter review, along with a pre-recorded question and answer segment that I did in Huntsville last week. So I actually have four questions pre-recorded. So you're just going to get the Bible chapter review here. Then you're going to get one of the questions I pre-recorded. I think the question is about telling the truth biblically, like bearing false witness. It's from Jeff in Florida. And then you're going to get the show topic that I recorded this morning called Too Small to Steal. So here we go. Beep, I've never heard that kind of beep before. Here we go into the Bible chapter review. We are in Matthew chapter 5 still. Let me turn my air up. It's hot. Matthew chapter 5. Today we're going to do verse 20. This is a pivotal verse because we're going to pivot from Jesus talking about being the salt of the earth and the light of the world, basically about discipleship, what it means to be a disciple. He's going to pivot to what it is to live a righteous life. This is how the disciples should act. So verse 20 here, as I said, is a pivotal statement. What does verse 20 say? Matthew 5, verse 20. For I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And I will not enter I-75 unless I slow down and then speed up a little bit, because there was a tractor trailer in the right lane. So why don't you chew on that biblical thought without commentary, or that biblical verse without commentary, while I try to get into the left lane. Because I cannot and will not do the Bible chapter review in the right lane or the middle lane. I have to get to my cruising speed. Like when you're on the airplane and you have to turn your headphones off and your computer off until you get to cruising altitude. And then magically, once you're above 10,000 feet, anything goes. Except for smoking. For I say to you, unless your righteousness far surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, we've talked about righteous living already in the Beatitudes. Well, what kind of attitude does a righteous person have? It's a kingdom-minded person, not a world-minded person. But Jesus is about to get more specific about that. And the reason this is a pivotal statement, because it's a prelude to several statements, starting in verse 21. You have heard it said. You have heard it said, but I say to you. So when he says here, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So when he says, you have heard it said, several times in verses 21 onwards, who's saying it? It's the scribes and Pharisees that are saying it. They're the ones who are the teachers of the law, saying, well, this is how it is. Oh, well, these guys must be righteous. We're going to these guys for our standard of righteousness. They're telling us this is God's standard of righteousness out of God's word, out of what we now call the Old Testament. But Jesus is saying, no, it's not at that level. It's a greater level of righteousness than that of the scribes and Pharisees. And with that, we will end this short Bible chapter review. And then I'm going to splice in Jeff's question. And then I'm going to splice in the show topic, Too Small to Steal. All right, this question comes from Jeff in Florida. He called it in on the Christian Commute Roadside Assistance Line. That number is 470-315-0875. And if anybody is keeping up, that's the last phone number that I ever remembered, the Christian Commute Roadside Assistance Line. Before that, the last phone number I ever remembered was my wife's. And I will, I won't give you hers, because then y'all people will call and complain at her about my answers. So, Christian Commute Roadside Assistance Line is where this came. I talked to Jeff about it. Did he leave a message or I talked to him about it? I don't remember. You can also write SethDunn88@gmail.com, but let's get down to the question. The question is, does bearing false witness against thy neighbor only apply in court? So we're talking about the Ten Commandments. What do the Ten Commandments say? Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. So Jeff's question is, given that there are a number of people in the Bible that lie and they're good guys, is this, are they not breaking this commandment? I think is what he's getting at. And he gives some examples of those people. The spies from Joshua. So you will remember the spies from Joshua. They go in to the city of Canaan to scope it out. Rahab hides them. And she makes a deal to be saved along with her family, because she says the fear of the Lord is, fear of you has fallen upon us. You know, we know the Lord's going to wipe us out, basically. So Rahab sides with the Jews against the Canaanites, and when the city, the residents of the city of Jericho come to her, she sends them the wrong way. So here we have Rahab. She's a good guy. She lies to the bad guys. And the spies from Israel get away. Then we have Hushai, I can't pronounce this right. It's in 2 Samuel. It's someone from David's court. And when Absalom tries his insurrection, David sends him back and says, well, just act like you're on his side and then you can report what he's doing to me. So Hushaiah, the double agent. And then Shipra and Pua, we have them in Exodus 1. So in Exodus 1, again, more good guys. These are Hebrew midwives. And Pharaoh has given the order to have all Hebrew boys killed at birth. So he tells these midwives, listen, if you go to help deliver a baby from among the Hebrews, if it's a boy, you kill it. If it's a girl, you let her live. And then they don't do it. They disobey him because they don't want to kill the babies. And when he asks them, why aren't you killing the babies? He's like, they're like, hey, Pharaoh, the Hebrew women are more vigorous than the Egyptian women. We only have time to get there to deliver the babies, but they've already had them. So that's their excuse. So, well, by the time we get there, they've already got the baby and we can't kill it. That's what they say. So here we have people who are, again, the good guys, lying or being deceptive. And Jeff sees these guys, these men and women, I should say, acting like that. You'll have to bear with my silence. I missed my turn. I'm on the way back from Huntsville right now. So, I guess I better explain it. I'm using the drive home in Huntsville to record about 5 or 6 question answers. So this is going to be spliced into some show of me answering a question. But it might not be the same as the start of the show. So trying to keep continuity. So that Jeff gets down to this question. The Bible says, thou shalt not bear false witness. But hey, look at these people. They're lying. So what does it mean in the Ten Commandments? Is it just talking about a court case? The answer, in short, Jeff, is no. It's not just talking about court cases. So let's look at the implications of your question, Jeff. So Jeff's asking, does thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, only apply in court? So you could think of a situation where there's a trial where somebody is being brought up on charges, and you lie about that person on the stand, as it were, and then they get in trouble. So because you lied about this person and you bared false witness against them, they got punished. So think about the Hebrew system of law where you had to have two or three witnesses to convict somebody. Like that was a legal thing. All right, we're not going to convict anybody without two or three witnesses. So they didn't have the exact same court system we had today with the judge and a jury of the peers. But they still had something like that when a crime was committed, and they were trying to mete out justice in their judicial system, and they had the law, they had the rule, don't convict anybody except upon the testimony of two or three witnesses. But two or three witnesses could conspire and lie about someone and have them punished. Well, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Of course you wouldn't. You know, that's lying. That's bad in a court case. But when Jeff says, does that only apply when testifying in court, I have to ask you, Jeff, well, which court? A court of ancient Israel? Like an Old Testament theocracy of Israel court? Or a civil court of the United States? A civil court of North Korea? A civil court of France? Any kind of country you can think of, some tribe in Africa? You know, whatever government authority is having the court. Because if you're just going to say a court case, well, then you have to define what court. Because remember, in the books of the law, we're talking about the law of Israel. And it all goes together. That's why when we look at the Ten Commandments, we have to take out what we call all the time the general equity. Thou shalt not murder. Well, in the United States, it's not legally considered murder to have an abortion. Morally, under the what? General equity, that baby is being murdered. So you can't just say, oh, well, this applies in court only. Well, which court? Because different courts have different rules. So the reason I bring that up, Jeff, is you don't want to be too narrow and constricting. Or say, oh, that's talking about court. Yeah, but their courts are different than any other court. So that's the first thing to bring up when you're thinking about, does this only apply in court? And then let's talk about this just when we're talking about being dishonest or lying. Let me back up. What about testimony about yourself? So if you're in court and you've been accused of a crime and you get called to the stand and they say, Jeff, did you burn down the abortion clinic? Somebody has arsoned this abortion clinic and burned it down. Was it you? And the abortionists, right? They're the bad guys, right, Jeff? They're killing babies. They're like Pharaoh, they're killing innocent babies. That's what they're doing at the abortion clinic. They're the bad guy. So you being the good guy, you want to burn it down. And now you're called to the stand. Now, the United States, we have the Fifth Amendment where you're not required to testify against yourself. I guess in the wisdom that our founders thought, like, even if somebody did it, they're not going to say they did. So let's just not even have it where you have to testify against yourself. And there's probably other various reasons for that. If you could legally testify against yourself, the government would try, you know, a corrupt government at least could try and coerce you into admitting guilt, or they're going to do something bad to your friends or family, whatever. So let's say you're called to testify that you burnt down the abortion clinic down there in Florida, Jeff, and you say, "Nah, man, I didn't do it. Wasn't me." And in your mind, you're going to go burn down another one. Wasn't me. Well, you didn't bear false witness against who? Your neighbor. You're talking about yourself. You lied, but you didn't bear false witness against your neighbor.
Did you?
No, because you bore false witness, but you were talking about yourself. And if we start saying things like, oh, it's only in a court case and it's only against your neighbor, do you see how this gets people? I wouldn't bear false witness against my neighbor. I was just talking about myself. Got to be careful. Now let's move on from what about testimony about yourself to God's character and nature. So go to Numbers 23:19. Is God a man that he should lie, or the son of man that he should repent? God can't lie. He cannot do it. Now, God can't really get in trouble with anybody, can he? You could argue, well, Jesus is God, and he was before human courts, and he could have tried to give testimony so he wasn't going to be crucified. They killed him, but what happened? He resurrected. So God's he's omnipotent. He doesn't need to lie to get his way. He just gets his way. So we think about the motivation to lie. I can't imagine that God would have a motivation to lie because he's sovereign. But God's character is such that he cannot lie. So as Christians, do we want to reflect God's character to other people, especially lost people? How do we look if we lie? Let me give you an example of a time where I lied. I was wrong and I shouldn't have done it. But it wasn't in court, and I wasn't bearing false witness against any neighbor. So I was in my transportation class in high school, which, by the way, I shouldn't. Some of my friends, college preppy people, you know, we took transportation class thinking, oh, this will be easy. Like, we didn't belong in there. But that's another story. So one day, we had a substitute come in. And this is not like math class or English class where a substitute can come in and do it and, like, teach you the math or go through the lesson with you. You just can't. It's transportation. You have to know about cars. So we have some lady in there. She can't teach us anything about cars. We're not going to change any brakes. Plus, we got to have supervision. You know, we got drills and wrenches and stuff. So my friends and I, we were juniors. We said, "Hey, can we have a pass and go read in the library?" Now, we never intended to go to the library. As my friend Joseph Womack was with me for sure, and I'm having trouble remembering who the other two guys were. Maybe Clayton Porter, I don't know. But there's four of us, and we never go to the library with this pass from the substitute. We go to Cody J's. Like, we go out to eat and get some breakfast. And we stop by one of our friend's house who was out of school that day for whatever reason. And then we come back. And we smelled like the restaurant. It's one of these restaurants you go, you can tell you've been eating. Well, here's what happened. The assistant principal came looking for me. Because I had done something else to get in trouble. I don't remember what it was. But I got assigned detention. Two detentions. And I was under the impression that I only had one detention. Because of an honest miscommunication. So I went into one detention, and then I didn't go to the second one. So now I'm AWOL, right? I violated the terms of my parole. So the assistant principal comes in, calls for me in the class. I'm not there. I'm in the library, right? That's where the substitute had sent us. So the substitute sends one of the kids in class, Stephen. What's his last name? Was it Stephen Jackson? I think his last name was Jackson. He comes to the library. We're not there, of course, because we were gone. So eventually we get back to school before the class period is over. These are block schedule classes, so they're an hour and a half long. I think hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, I think. And it's like, well, Mr. Harwood was looking for you. You got to go to Mr. Harwood's office. So there I am. I'm in the assistant principal's office. And he goes, yeah, Stephen. Stephen came to find you. I was like, oh, yeah, you sent Stephen, huh? I was like, yeah, you're a real sleuth. You sent Sherlock Holmes to get the job done. Being sarcastic, you know, oh, you sent Stephen. I was like, Stephen, you say? I mean, I said it like that, like, oh, yes, he must be some buffoon. Maybe if you didn't send a buffoon, he would have found me. And he's like, yeah, he didn't find you. And I was like, you know, I was in the bathroom for a pretty long time. People don't like to talk about bathroom stuff. It makes them uncomfortable. I was in the bathroom for a pretty long time. And then I quickly pivot. Well, what was it about in the first place? Like, let's forget about where I was. What's all this about? What's all this about? And he goes, well, you missed your detention. I was like, oh, no, I didn't. I went to this detention. Yeah, but you were supposed to have this other detention. I said, oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I will make up my detention. And I did. So anyway, what would have happened to me if I'd have got caught skipping school? I would have gotten even more trouble. And what did I do? I lied to get out of trouble. And was I in court? No, I was in the assistant principal's office. Was I bearing false witness against somebody else? No, I was the one accused being found. I wasn't saying like, oh no, yeah, these other guys weren't out. Like I wasn't saying where my friends were. I wasn't saying where Steven was. And listen, Harwood's not an idiot. All right, I think he knew I was lying, and that's how I justified it to myself. I was, well, he knew I was lying anyway. No, that was wrong. So I wasn't in court, and I wasn't talking about somebody else. Was it still wrong? Yeah, I lied. What was my motive to get out of trouble? What's that say about my character? Bad. What if I wanted to witness to Mr. Harwood later? I don't know if he was a Christian or not. He lived in my neighborhood. That doesn't make somebody a Christian. What if I wanted to share Christ with him later? Oh, this is a guy who lies. How's he different from me? He'll lie to get out of trouble. I want to reflect Christ's character. As a Christian. So I want to be honest with people always. Not lie. Even if, oh, well, you're not really breaking the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments is about bearing false witness against your neighbor. True. It is about bearing false witness against my neighbor. But it doesn't give me liberty to lie. Because I want to reflect God's character. God can't lie. If I have faith in God to deliver me no matter what, like the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. O king, you can toss us in the furnace, but God will save us. And even if he doesn't, that's okay. Paraphrasing what they said. Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? We will not bow. We will not bow. You can toss us in the furnace. The king didn't really want to toss him in the furnace. He got kind of tricked into it. Our God will save us. Even if he doesn't, we will not bow. We're going to do the right thing no matter what. And that's the attitude that we need to have as Christians. Honest people who don't lie. So yeah, bearing false witness against your neighbor. And I think I've made it clear, it doesn't have to be in court. Think of something like this. If I didn't like my neighbor and I saw his wife out one day, I said, you know, while you were gone on vacation, your husband had another woman over. It's none of my business, but I'd like somebody to tell me. It's not in court, but it's still slander and gossip. It's still bearing false witness against somebody. It's still lying. So it doesn't have to be in court, and it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be in court, but it's when you're saying something against someone else, you're breaking that commandment. Does that apply to all lies? So you have to get to the question, does the lie I'm telling, does it somehow hurt someone else? Is there a tort, if you will, against somebody else? And the answer is always yes. Let me bring it down. Because everybody likes to use, I think, the Corrie Ten Boom example. And it was a real example for her. People use it as a hypothetical example, but for her it was a real example. Nazis are at your door. So you're in Nazi Germany. You're hiding Jews in your house, because if you don't hide them, they're going to get sent to the concentration camp and gassed. Listen, I've been in one of those gas chambers. I've toured it. I've been in a concentration camp. A Dachau in Munich when I was a kid. I'll never forget it. There's some things in your life you will never forget that stick with you. That's what sticks with me. So the Nazis come and they knock on your door. Hey, you hiding any Jews in there? Nope, no Jews. What'd you do? You just lied to them. Yeah, but I was trying to save the Jews. Hey, what are you doing the rest of the day in Germany? Do you have a job? Do you go to your job and work at your job to contribute to the economy of Germany? You paying your property tax? Do you live in a nice, comfortable house because the German government, the Nazi government, protects your property rights? Listen, if the government, if the police are out taking people away and putting them in concentration camps because of their ethnicity, you don't need to be sitting in your house comfortably. You need to be burning down the police station. It's like, Seth, what if the police come to take my guns away in violation of the Second Amendment? Shoot them. But they're the police. Nah, they're not. Once they start violating the Constitution and taking your guns, you shoot them. Once they start trying to steal your neighbors and put them in a concentration camp, you can no longer be a good citizen of Germany. See what I mean? So the guy who's asking about the Jews in your basement or in the attic or wherever they are, he's probably lost. Knock, knock, knock. Hello. You got any Jews in there? Yeah, Vol, I got some Jews in here. They're hiding from you, you wretched man, that you've come to murder them. What's going to happen when you stand before God one day? You think you have a problem standing before Goebbels or Hitler? You're going to stand before Jesus Christ one day, and you're going to have to answer for taking part in this murder. You're not right with God. Repent. Come to Christ. The person who's persecuting you almost certainly needs to hear the gospel. I can't imagine trying to lie to someone instead of evangelizing him and that being the proper moral choice and me saying, well, the Ten Commandments said don't bear false witness against my neighbor. Yeah, I lied, but I didn't bear false witness against my neighbor. Now, does that mean I'm going to do that if the Nazis knock on my door? I couldn't even tell the truth to Mr. Harwood. What, was I going to get another detention? I have to get up early again? It's not like Nazis coming to kill me and my family. But guys, if we trust God to deliver us, can we not tell the truth in the name of a God who cannot lie? Can we not tell the truth in the name of a God who cannot lie and trust Him to take care of us? So when you get down to the Ten Commandments, yeah, it's really, it's not judicial. It can apply judicially, but there's extrajudicial applications. The general equity of that law, if you, and by the way, you won't find the term general equity in Scripture anywhere. It's a Reformation term. I didn't make it up. I'm just borrowing it. But you look at the general equity of those commandments, and it's doing right by God and doing right by your neighbor. Every one of those commandments is about doing right by God or doing right by your neighbor. And that's what Jesus is talking about when he says the greatest commandment is to love your Lord, the Lord your God, with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Do you want to be lied to? Who is my neighbor? That's another thing. Don't bear false witness against my neighbor. Well, that guy's not my neighbor. That guy's not my neighbor. What's the question that was the lawyer asked Jesus? Who is my neighbor? Oh, no, the Samaritan is my neighbor. Going back to the parable of the Good Samaritan. When we start looking at the Ten Commandments and saying, well, you know, it's just technically talking about a judicial situation, and it's technically only if it's saying something bad against your neighbor. You got the letter of the law, but not the spirit, man. So short answer on your question. Boy, I went 23 minutes on this. Hey, I got a long ride home. Short answer on your question, Jeff, is no. Bearing false witness against thy neighbor does not only apply in court. And I think I've made a... Even if you disagree with me on my it's never okay to lie stance, even if you disagree with me on that, I think I've made the case that it doesn't only apply in court. And I want to shed some more light on the subject, all right? Who lies? Who lies and thinks it's okay? If we just look at the world. Where you have Muslims and their doctrine of taqiyya, where Muslims can lie to you and say, oh no man, we're not Muslim. We're not here to take over your country for the house of Allah. Because you know Muslim has the two houses, the house of God and the house of war. Oh, no, we're not Muslims. So the Muslims can lie to infidels. Taqiyya is what they call that. Jehovah's Witnesses can lie to you too. Did you know that? You worldling, they can lie to you. I learned that by reading the book Rescuing Slaves of the Watchtower by Joe B. Hewitt, former Jehovah's Witness. When you don't tell the truth, I'm going to say this again. When you don't tell the truth, I believe it's demonstrating a lack of faith in a Lord who cannot lie. When you don't tell the truth, you are demonstrating a lack of faith in a Lord, God, who cannot lie. So thanks for writing that question in, Jeff. Went really long on that. But I hope you appreciate the long answer. And so ends that question. All right, so let's talk about being too small to steal. And this is going to be a rare bit of pragmatism on the Christian commute. Because you guys know, excuse me, you guys know I constantly reject the pragmatism that is just constricting the evangelical churches right now. Like, oh, let's do this to get people in. Or, well, I know this is a spiritual thing to do, but this won't work. Yeah, I know it's, you know, smoke machines aren't good, but it'll get people in. Pragmatism. I hate that. We do not form and operate the Lord's church based on pragmatic principles. I mean, my gosh, look at the Bible. It says if you're going to be righteous and live for Christ, you're going to get persecuted. So we don't live our Christian lives in our Christian church based on pragmatism. If you do that, well, you get what we have in American evangelicalism today. And also what I have is coffee, so hold on. It's a rare morning commentary. But I'm going to give you and your church a bit of pragmatic advice today about takeovers. Let's talk about being too small to steal. Too small to steal. We've heard about being too big to fail. Remember when the economy got really bad a few years ago? And it looked like General Motors, and I think was Dodge, Chrysler Dodge, I can't remember. It looked like they were going to go bankrupt, Ford too, and the government bailed out GM. And they said, we can't let GM fail. It's too big to fail. We can't just let General Motors go out of business and the market take its course. So if General Motors went out of business, or they went bankrupt, I mean, their assets would probably get sold off to various other automotive companies. And more companies would come in their wake and make the cars and trucks that people want and try to do it in a more profitable way. But in the meantime, a lot of people would be out of jobs. Sometimes I don't think we fathom how many people work, not just in Detroit, but how many people in the United States work for these big companies, even the ones that aren't particularly profitable. Think like Delta Airlines. They've gone bankrupt before. But what if Delta went out of business? I mean, 9 out of 10 flights I've ever taken in my life have been on Delta. And there are innumerable pilots, stewardesses, gate agents, baggage handlers, I mean, mechanics, you name it, where I live in Atlanta, who work for Delta. It would really hurt the city's economy if Delta went out of business. Now, would I eventually find a different airline to get where I needed to go? Yeah, and somebody would eventually come into the void. Same thing for General Motors. Think of how many people work in their factories. And not just the people working in the factories, but the office administrative people and secretaries and all the people on down the line. Here comes more coffee. Riveting. So the government decided Ford and GM, well, they're too big to fail. And Ford said, you know, we're having a rough time, but we're not going to take the government money. And they didn't. They somehow survived. But GM took the government bailout money, and that's why they're now called Government Motors. Now, if you're another car company doing business in the United States, you're going to be a little offended at that, I guess. Like, yeah. Think of how hard you've worked as some startup car company, not that I can name one. But let's say you're Honda or you're Toyota, and you've worked hard for your market position, and you finally get the chance to put them out of business. And like, no, the government's going to come bail them out. This is not how competition works. But the government is heavily influenced by the AFL-CIO, which is a big labor union. So it's not just people who are going to be out of jobs. It's people who are members of powerful labor unions that are going to be out of jobs. And one might argue that the reason General Motors couldn't be competitive is because their labor costs too much. They have these labor unions have these sweetheart deals with these people, and other car manufacturers are making cars that perform just as well or better without having the crippling labor deals. Like, all right, you're going to get $30 an hour and 4 weeks of vacation because you're in the union, stuff like that. One might argue that's why they were failing. Anyway, I can sit here and say that this is why the government bailed them out, or this is why the government out, but the government bailed them out. But basically, the argument was they were too big to fail. Listen, if Tesla went out of business, they'd just go bankrupt and somebody else would make electric cars. How many Teslas do you see on the road? They're not too big to fail. They're intriguing. And maybe one day they'll be too big to fail, but they're not right now. So why am I talking about too big to fail? Why am I talking about the auto industry or the airline industry or industry in general? Well, I want to ask you this. Is your church too big to fail? Is it so influential on the community that if your church broke up or went out of business, not that churches are quote-unquote in business, that it would hurt the community? And a lot of us, we should be saying, well, wait a second, it would hurt the community if our church went out of business. You know, we're not huge, but you know, we're feeding the poor, we're evangelizing. So don't take it the wrong way. Your church should be affecting your community in a positive way. You got to affect the community in a positive way. I sound like every athlete who's ever got a post-game interview. Yeah, I started this foundation because I wanted to affect the community, just to give back and do something positive. But seriously, you know, all joking aside, your church should be affecting the community in a positive way. Not just with the influence on the gospel, but with like feeding people and giving poor kids backpacks or whatever. Here it's the start of school now, so we got to give poor kids backpacks. Hadn't had morning coffee in a while. I tell you, it's good. I don't drink a lot of coffee. It tears me up. I usually drink tea. Anyway, back to my point about being too big to fail. If you're one of these churches or businesses that is super influential, people are going to want that. So if you want to be a titan of industry, if you're an investor, you're going to want to invest in businesses, well, number one, that are profitable, but number two, have some kind of influence. You might not necessarily want to invest in GM. They weren't doing real well for their investors. But you want to be a part of an industry that has some influence, not a bunch of nobodies, if you want to change things. If you want to change the way cars are made, if you think, I don't like how cars are made, I think they guzzle too much gas or they're not environmentally friendly, well, you can start your own little car company or you can take over GM and start defining what cars are. Listen, Ford and GM are like, here are the cars. This is what a pickup truck is. Here is the standard for a pickup truck. It's an F-150. Here you go. Oh, you don't like an F-150? Here's a GMC Sierra. Here's a Chevy Z71. Chevy Silverado. That's what a pickup truck is in America. So you can make your own different little pickup truck, or you can go to the people who define what trucks are, because they're such titans of industry, and say, here it is. And here's my daily lament when I pass somebody with a Woodstock City Church. I am in Adairsville. What are you doing with your Woodstock City Church sticker all the way up here? Andy Stanley's wicked influence. So sad. Now, what about churches? This is where it gets down to. If you want to be a social justice warrior, are you going to go to Podunk Baptist Church with 70 members, 6 miles off I-75? I mean, I'm passing, what is this, exit 306, Adairsville, Somerville. I pass it every day, but I haven't driven to work in forever. But I pass it every day that I go to work. Every Christian commute on I-75, I pass this exit. I could go off this exit, turn right or turn left, and run into some church you've never heard of. It wouldn't take me long. But if you want to be a social justice warrior and really get big money and big influence, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the big churches. That's the one, what, you're going to try and take over. Remember, today's show topic is too small to steal. Not worth stealing. It's like some of my cars. I've got so many cars now. But I got that, was it a 2010 Kia Soul? I don't even like that thing. Nobody's going to steal my 2010 Kia Soul. And if I had anything valuable for somebody to take out of it, I would be so rich that I didn't own a 2010 Kia Soul. I mean, I don't have anything in there but my books. I give them away. Oh, you want to take my book? Here, take my book. But I don't have diamond rings sitting in there. Yeah, I don't have a... Remember back in the late 90s, you could take your CD player with you. I had one of these because people would steal CD players when they were newer in cars. And you put your aftermarket CD player in your car and you could pop it off and put it in your backpack when you went to school, or pop it off and lock it in the glove compartment, because people would break a window and steal CD players because they were so expensive. But nobody's going to break into my Kia Soul. And if they do want to, they can just open the door because I ain't locking the thing. It ain't worth it. You want to hotwire my Kia Soul? Have at it, buddy. It's worth $3,000. Go for it. You just got yourself a Kia Soul with 150,000 miles and a Grand Theft Auto charge. I lock Studio. Which is it? Studio, Studio E? My brand new black Odyssey with the leather seats and the fanciness. I lock that thing. Because I got stuff in there worth stealing. All my kids put their stuff in. I probably got an Amazon Fire tablet pad in there. But the door ain't locked on the Kia Soul because it's too small to steal. But when you get your big churches that start to have schools and then they go multi-campus, well, then the devil's people, or they get their eye on that and they say, I'm going to take that. Think about in the Old Testament. Remember the Old Testament? We had the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, and the Northern Kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians, but the Southern Kingdom was still going strong. But then the King of Israel invited a Babylonian delegation in, like, hey, look at my nice city. Look at this temple. Look at all the gold and fancy stuff I have. He was showing off. And then the Babylonians, a little while later, are like, hey, let's go take that place over and take all their stuff. So if you've got a bunch of stuff that you're showing everybody, somebody's going to want to take it. By the way, I'm not applying the Bible to say, this is what the Bible, that's the lesson from the Bible. Don't show off your stuff or somebody will take it. Not that, you know, we should be modest as Christians and not be showy, of course. But remember FBC Naples, First Baptist Church in Naples? The North American Mission Board, denominational social justice people, they sent Marcus Hayes there, didn't they? And that church had a school, and it was really big, and it delivered a lot of money to the cooperative program. Did they go to the First Baptist Church of Palatka? I'm sure there is one. Google it. First Baptist Church of Palatka. I bet Palatka has 3 or 4 Baptist churches. Y'all ever been to Palatka? I have. There is a giant paper mill there, a Georgia Pacific paper mill, and that's why I went there when I was in the internal audit department at Georgia Pacific. And to get to Palatka, you fly into Miami, a big vibrant city, and then you drive out to Palatka. By the way, these paper mills, they do not put the paper mills in the major metro area, because paper mills need a big river and they kind of smell. right? The paper mills tend to be kind of out in the country, right? Nobody's going to go steal First Baptist Church of Palatka. But Naples, woo-hoo! Hey, Ronnie Nall, if you don't know him, if you're on my Facebook, you know Ronnie Nall. Ronnie Nall goes to First Baptist Naples. That dude's rich. First Baptist Naples was built by rich people in Florida. Rich people in Florida. And it was nice. I guess it still is. Building school. That's who the SJWs and the denominational elites want to get in and take. That's where you're going to get Marcus Hayes. And then now we learn about McLean Bible Church in Virginia. Now that's still playing out. I don't have as much information as I had as about First Baptist Church in Naples. I talked to members of FBC Naples, several of them. This was a long time ago. I did several shows on it. But you sniff McLean Bible Church in Virginia, the David Platt's church. He seems to be making a lot of appearances on the Christian Commute lately. And you get the sense maybe the same thing's kind of trying to go on, that the small elite people, they've tried to like weed their way in, take control of the church and point it in a direction that the people who've been going there and donating there for years don't want to take it, into a social justice direction. And you think about, well, how do the leftists and social Justinians, how do they want to influence our young people in a secular way, not a church way, in a secular way? What do? Well, they get jobs at the university. And they become professors to influence the young people. Here's how this works. Joe Blue Collar gets a job at Ford. And he works there for 30 years. And he raises his kids. He's like in the Alan Jackson song, Small Town Southern Man. And he bowed his head to Jesus. And he stood for Uncle Sam. And he only loved one woman. He was proud of what he had, said his greatest contribution, you're the ones he left behind, raised on the love and gentle kindness of a small town southern man. Just that kind of working man. People like my Uncle Bobby. I can't think of just a more virtuous family member than my Uncle Bobby. What did my Uncle Bobby do? He didn't do anything but go to work for 30 years, raised his family, supported his wife, and was a good granddad, you know, paid his taxes, pledged the flag, and carried his handgun. He was a great American. God bless my Uncle Bobby. May he rest in peace. But, you know, that's just a blue-collar guy who's successful, goes to work, owns his house, and raises his family. You can be in the North, you could be in the South, you could be in the East or the West. But, we, you know, backbone, what we call salt of the earth people. What do? They go to work for 30 years. They have a measure of success. And then maybe they don't go to college, but they make so much money that their kids can go to college. And then they send their kids to college. What happens at college? They get indoctrinated by leftist professors. I went to business school at UGA, so I didn't come across a lot of the leftist professors. But listen, they're there. Look at a map of Georgia. And for that matter, look at a map of Alabama, or look at a map of Tennessee. And when you find the little blue dots, it'll either be a big city or the college town. By a map, I mean like a little voter map. So when leftists want to enter society, well, they go into academia. When leftists want to influence the church, they go into the big churches with the schools and the multi-campus. And they go into what? The North American Mission Board. They take over the big things. But what if your church is too small to steal and you're just working with your hands and not dependent on anybody, living a quiet life in your church? Yes, influencing the community in a good way. People say, I'm glad that church is here because they help feed our poor. Nobody's coming in to steal those churches yet. You might get some liberal guy from the seminary to come and kind of wet his teeth. But then, you know, they'll send him on to the FBC Naples and the McLean Bible churches of the world. And it's kind of sad for me because I start covering these stories
Or not, I covered FBC Naples. I wrote some blogs, and did I write a blog about it? I know I podcasted about it. But we wrote about it at Pulpit and Pen. And I know John Harris is covering McLean, and Capstone Reporter is covering McLean. But I see these, and these are guys I talk to, by the way. Like, we all know each other, in case you don't know. Like, all the discernment blogger people, that we all know each other. Right. We're covering these things, and I see it, and I'm from the outside looking in, and I'm just sad. And I'm like, you don't deserve to have your church stolen, but what did you expect? You weren't guarding the door. Yeah, you're not leaving the door open on your Kia Soul. You're leaving the door open on your Cadillac. What did you think would happen? And somewhere along the line, as you guys were growing, and I'm speaking to these huge churches, like you just kind of ignored church membership. You just expected to just kind of give but not vote and control and congregational rule. And you got away from ecclesiology where you started doing multi-campus stuff. And you got 10 different pastors on staff. And you got so big that nobody knows one another. Well, you got a life group. You know everybody in your life group. But you don't know the other people in the church. The pastors don't really know you or your family, average member. And what it becomes is like one of these charities that exists not to help the poor, but to give a salary to the board members or the executives. And we know that can happen with charity. There's a famous story. I've heard it from several pastors. I assume it's true. We know pastors make up stories about some charity that started out to make like a lighthouse in a port town. And then by the end, they had a bunch of money and nobody even cared about the lighthouse. That's what it's like. Like John David Eddy at FBC Naples. He'd love to have Marcus Hayes in because he can then get up and get a big step out to go be the senior guy somewhere else. David Platt, McLean Bible Church. David Platt went to seminary in New Orleans and then got a job out of seminary in Alabama and then went to the IMB and totally out of McLean Bible Church, this independent Bible church. It's like this one of this, you didn't build that thing. All of a sudden, now he's in charge. He didn't build it up. And we said, well, God, you know, God builds the church up. Jesus said, I'll build my church. Yeah, but he was doing it through all those people who were showing up every week for 20 years and donating. I mean, Lon Solomon was the pastor when that church was founded, and it all grew under his pastorate. And then David Platt's like kind of the guy who comes into Canaan, into the promised land. He's like, well, I'm going to live in a city I didn't build with crops, milk and honey I didn't plant. You know, that's probably, you know, I bet that's how these guys justify themselves. Like, yeah, it's like I'm going into Canaan, like turn it into the promised land. I'm going to live in a nice house that I didn't build because God's given it to me. I don't know if they feel that way or not, but guys, maybe keep your church so small. First of all, so small it's biblical. Don't go multi-campus. Don't make it like a business. But what do you expect to happen when you make your church too big to fail? Somebody's going to come in and steal it. The social justice people want it. And as the social justice movement takes over Big Eva, guess what's going to happen? The churches that were too small to steal, they're still going to be there. And I hope you're at one. Thanks for listening to The Christian Commute. Lord willing, I'll be back with you again some other time. This is a pre-recorded show topic. I'm just going to stick it on to some other pre-recorded stuff. God bless. Miss Sharon. Miss you guys.
Thanks for listening to The Christian Commute. Please send your questions about Christian apologetics and theology to sethdunn88@gmail.com. If you are not a Christian, please remember that you can be reconciled to God through the shed blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. The Bible teaches that all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. Repent of your sins now and accept Jesus as Lord. God bless.